from the Children's Centre in Vancouver, Washington. This is Hope and Healing. I'm Matthew Butte, Executive Director of Children's Centre, and your host. We make this podcast in order to bring you hopeful stories and to introduce you to people who inspire hope. They've inspired a lot of hope in me and among people here at Children's Centre, and I hope you feel the same. Dr. Al Vacchione is the founder and clinical director of the Francis Foundation, a private nonprofit that serves people with extremely challenging behavior. He is also the co-founder of the Vermont Crisis Intervention Network, the only statewide crisis service for people with developmental disabilities in the country, as well as the founder of the Francis Foundation Learning Center, a school that serves children and adolescents with traumatic histories and unmanageable behavior. At the Children's Center, we have been fortunate to welcome Al as a trainer, and we have learned so much from him. When it comes to trauma, mental health, and developmental disabilities, he's taught us that the body is the battleground in which this struggle is played out. He's taught us practical body-based techniques that either calm or activate us, depending on what we need. Techniques we share with our clients, and techniques you can learn too. And in the midst of these challenging times, with his stories of healing, his warmth and humor inspires hope in all of us. I spoke with Al Vacchione over Zoom from his home in Vermont. As we start the interview, Al, just so you know, I'm here with my standard British cup of tea, as you would expect. How about you? Do you have a beverage with you that you like?
My standard Polar Seltzer. I don't have my Italian seltzer today, but Polar is my backup.
So then that means we're both ready to go. You've been doing this work for a very long time, and we're going to talk about the work that you do. But before we do, can you tell us how you got started?
I graduated from the University of Illinois with a degree in biology, which made me uniquely qualified to pour concrete, which I did for a while. And then it got too cold to pour concrete. And so I came home and I said to my wife, well, we're going to have to find something else to do because, you know, I'm getting laid off in a week. And she said, well, let me look in the paper. And she did. And she said, I found a job in a children's home. And she said, you know, at the time I was volunteering at the boys club and, you know, I like kids. And anyway, so did she. And so I said, well, you know, I'd be happy to apply, but they'll never hire us because we don't have any experience. And we're not a whole lot older than the kids they're asking us to look after. And so we went into the job interview. And of course, we were hired immediately, not because it was a great interview, but because we're the only people who apply. And so they said it was a Friday. Can you just go out Monday? And sure enough, we did. And, you know, I learned in those early years all of the things not to do. And so, you know, when we get started, they said, you know, we have an incentive program for the kids. And by the way, it was me and my wife. We had a fellow who helped out once in a while. And we had 12 adjudicated delinquents, all boys, all teenagers, in the same house, which clearly was not a good idea. But anyway, they told us about this incentive program. We said, wow, incentive program, that seems like a good thing to do, you know, give people stuff. I didn't even know what it meant, really, but it sounded good, you know. And so what it was that the kids were each on a level, and each week they got graded on their behavior, basically, from the week before. And that level that they got set all of their privileges, their allowance, bedtime, off-campus time, all of these things. Many of them didn't really seem like privileges to me. They seemed like rights. But anyway, I didn't know. And so we'd have a weekly meeting, and you assume an incentive program, everybody would be incentivized and happy and excited. And every week, a couple of kids blew out of the meeting, cursing, didn't like their level. And by the way, so the levels were 1 to 5, and 5 was the highest. If you were at a 5, but you did something over the course of the week that most teenagers would do, like stay out late or, I don't know, whatever else, they bust you down to a 1. So you go from having all these privileges to having to be in your bedroom by 6 o'clock and not having an allowance and all these crazy things. So after a couple of these meetings, the psychiatrist was sitting next to me, and I leaned over to him and I said, after two kids blew out of the meeting, and when I mean blew out, they didn't just say, excuse me, I'll be back in a few minutes. I mean, they got up, they swore at the people, and they ran out of the room. which was better than hitting somebody, but still it was, you know, not great. And I said to the psychiatrist, I don't think this is working. And he said, yeah, this doesn't work at all. And that was it. So anyway, we did a few things at the house and changed things around because, first of all, it was a lot of violence. And, you know, nobody feels safe if there's violence in your home. And I was young, but I was, you know, fairly big and strong. And these guys were younger than me. And anyway, I said, boys, you know, there's no violence in the house. And that's it, you know. And if there is violence, I'm going to put you out. And the deal is you got to walk around the house to the front door, knock on my door, come in and talk to me about it, and then it's over. And, you know, the first weekend, I think I threw kids out of the house over 100 times, you know. But by the third or fourth day, we never had very little violence after that. And they didn't get in trouble. I didn't bust them down or do anything to them. I just talked to them and said, look, fellas, this is, we live together and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it went great. And we had a couple of days of the week that were pretty tough for the kids and pretty tough for all of us. And that was Friday night, Sunday night. And Friday night, I think, like most of us, we're off, you know, we're done with the week of school and a week of work, and we come home and we want to relax and kick back and enjoy our weekend. Except if you're on a level one, you're supposed to be in your bedroom at 6 o'clock, right? And so that really didn't work. So I said, okay, boys, this is what we're going to do. No levels on Friday night. We're going to get pizzas, we're going to play pool, we're going to watch movies, and we're going to hang out together in peace. And everybody went, okay. And so Friday night went from being one of the worst nights of the week to one of the best nights of the week. So Sunday was still an issue. And I think, again, it was a transition back, weekend relaxation, back to school on Monday. And all of these kids went to an on-ground school, which at the time I really couldn't appreciate just how traumatic it would be to go to a school where if you talked back or if you walked away, people would muckle onto you and restrain you and time you out and do all kinds of miserable things to you. Anyway, Sunday night was a tough night. So we did the same thing. We said Sunday they had a gym and, you know, facility. And I said, we're going to go to the gym. They had a pool, indoor pool. We're going to have contests. We're going to win prizes. We're going to barbecue. We're going to hang out and have a good time. And Sunday became the first or second best night of the week. So all of the things that we were taught to do that we thought was treatment made things worse. And just a little human kindness and consideration made things better. And so, you know, I guess the lesson I learned, and I was only 22 when we left there, you know, and my son was a newborn. And we came back to Vermont to build our house and make our gardens and raise our animals and family and all that stuff. And I guess I learned a lot about what not to do. And one of the things I probably didn't think about it this way then, it's the simple things that are the most profound. You know, there's CBT and DBT and all of these T's, and I got nothing against any of them, but, you know, they're 50 minutes in somebody's office once a week. What about a life, you know? What about a little kindness? What about a little bit of support? What about, you know, we're asking these kids to reach out to us. And that's the solution to their behavior problems. Reach out. Don't act out. Don't check out. Don't run away. Don't fight over it. Don't shut down, become avoidant, dissociate. Just come over and say, look, I'm having a hard time with this. Well, you got to trust people in order to be able to do that. And the roots of trust are not in DBT or CBT or EMDR. Those are good things, but they're in human relationships. And so I think we developed over time this really a trauma-informed, relationship-centered, not a person-centered, but a relationship-centered treatment where if people feel safe in their bodies and they feel safe in their relationship with you and they develop trust, they behave pretty well.
Those, drawing upon that experience where it all began, fast-forwarding to today, what does your work look like now and how you drawing upon those lessons and so many more years of experience?
Well, so, you know, we can't put aside the lessons I learned in between because, you know, I spent my life the last 50 years or close to it of my life with my friends and family, many of whom have developmental disabilities and mental health problems, and many of whom have challenging behavior. And on a day-to-day basis, they were teaching me things that I needed to know in order to be good at doing that. And at some point in the early 90s, we developed a statewide crisis service for people with developmental disabilities, which is the only one in the country, which sounds better than it is because Vermont's a small state and all that stuff, you know. But anyway, you know, I got to see new people every couple of weeks who are really challenging and had to support them in person. So, you know, I had to learn how to do that. And, you know, some of the lessons I learned early on were don't punish people. Be kind. Smile and do things with them that they enjoy. And, you know, those things work really well. And then, I learned a lot about developmental psychology and a whole lot of stuff that we currently apply in the treatment. But anyway, those were the fundamentals, you know. If people were in good relationships, we used to say the right person, when they were writing behavior plans in the old days, we'd say the right person doing the wrong plan always did better than the wrong person doing the right plan. You know, our current work, so we did this for well over 40 years, probably 45, 46, where we served, we had the statewide crisis service, but we served people in the developmental home model, which is, means that we put them in houses, single houses, because I learned early on, you put 12 people together. One person has a bad day every 12 days. It's a bad day every day, right? So we didn't do that. And we put people in individual homes. And they're not foster homes, but they're sort of like foster homes. So you could be with a wife and a husband and a couple of kids, but you could be two guys. Or you could be with one guy, one gal, or two gals, or, you know, whatever really worked for the person. And then we really put our time into fostering good relationships. Mm. So what the model that they were using then and is still used widely, it's the most widely used model, and the worst thing you can do, particularly to a traumatized person, is the direct threat and punish model, right? Cut it out. Don't do that anymore. If you don't stop doing that, I'm going to do this. And then you do this. You know, I just had a meeting with a kid the other day, and he has problems at school and lots of violence. But he never has violence with this one teacher. And I said, do you really like her class? He said, no. I said, well, how come no violence with Mrs. whatever her name is? He said, well, one day I was having a hard time in her class, and some of the kids said, you know, kick him out, get him out of here. And she stood up for me, and she said, if you guys don't like it, you leave. He's staying. And, I mean, there's your trust, right? One event, you know, and you build trust and build trust with people, not in the good times. The good times you have fun, and that's all great. It lays the foundation, but it's what you do in the bad times that tells people who you really are. So, you know, my son Leo says the key to our business is being kind to people all the time. And when they're having a really difficult time, be even kinder. And that seems like a pretty darn easy to follow rule, pretty simple, but pretty profound.
There was something that you said, well, you've said a lot of great things, Errol. There was something I want to go back to just a little bit. You mentioned about people feeling safe in their body, and you've done a lot of training for our staff here at Children's Center that we're so grateful for around body-based techniques to help change behavior, its impact on mental well-being. But someone might ask, what's the body got to do with all this? Can you tell us more about that?
The body is the repository of all experience and the springboard of all behavior, right? Everything that ever happens to you gets stored in your body. And when I say your body, I mean your body, your brain, your central nervous system, your autonomic nervous system, all of you. It's all in here, right? It's in procedural memory. It's how to respond to things, right? And so the body is then the springboard based on your experiences, springboard for how you think you should behave, and think you should behave is a bad way to say it, how you unconsciously have learned to behave in certain situations. So for example, I would say the key driver of the behavior we'd love to change in people is fear, right? People feel in danger and under threat most of the time, especially if you've been traumatized, right? We know that it changes the whole way your body and brain function. And that, in fact, is the definition of PTSD, is long-term changes in the way you think, the way you feel, in these intrusive things that keep coming back to you. But the most significant pieces are explosive and avoidant behavior, right? So trauma is defined by explosive and avoidant behavior. What are the behaviors we're trying to change in all these kids and people? Explosive and avoidant behavior, right? So they're afraid because they learn to be afraid. Your autonomic nervous system has got to be fast on its feet. In other words, if it's going to save you, it better do it quick because there's no second chances. So, you know, when you think about how a person responds to threat, the first thing it does is shut off the thinking part of your brain, which includes your memory, your short-term memory, and it shuts off your language center, right? So when people are really struggling, you know, we're so verbal as a society. What do? We go in and talk to them. We start telling them things. You know, if you do that, this is going to happen. Well, here's the consequence. You know, people should be able to say, by the way, my language center's not on. And also my memory center's not on. So I don't know what you're talking about. Instead, they get even more irritable and attack you, right? So I think it's widely accepted, you know, that the core of behavior problems is dysregulation. If we believe that, then what is the solution? Regulation, maybe, right? And so, you know, I think people get this some part of the time, but they regulate by telling people to go take a walk, go take a deep breath, and, you know, and they also tell them to stop because no language center, that doesn't work. And when you tell people to take a deep breath, guess what happens? Your heart rate speeds up. So that's no good. And take a walk. I mean, have you ever taken a walk when you're upset? You know, it takes, for me, a solid, you know, if I go for a walk in the woods when I'm upset, it takes a solid 20 minutes or half hour before I stop just repeating in my mind how bad the other person is and what he should have done that and how I was mistreated. It doesn't help. Right. Maybe at the end of the hour, after I've been out in the woods for a while, yeah, then I'm okay when I come back. You know, we need regulation activities that go to the core of the brainstem, right? Which regulates all your arousal and all the activities and heart rate and blood pressure. We need things that settle the dysregulated body down quickly, right? And so take a walk, don't do it, take a deep breath, or go color, or why don't you listen to music? I mean, these are all good things, but these are not going to the core of the brainstem and stopping things in their tracks, like some of the techniques we talk about. So, you know, breathing, for example, as everybody knows, terrific practice. Increases your heart rate variability, which means that it turns on your parasympathetic rest and digest system, right? It lowers your heart rate, it lowers your blood pressure, it changes the hormones, it changes your brain function. It shuts off your amygdala, which is the alarm system of your brain. It stops the drive to put blood in your large muscles, right? Because if you're going to hit somebody or run away, your blood's all out there. And so things like swimming, we do some technique where we just put our face in water, or you put a wet rag on somebody's face. Well, what happens is it triggers the mammalian diving reflex right to the brainstem, and it lowers your heart rate, lowers your blood pressure, lowers your cortisol, which is your stress hormone, and even changes your oxytocin and vasopressin levels. So, yeah, you know, be nice, take a walk, that's fine, all right? But it is going to help somebody who's dysregulated. And those practices that we do with people, we have to institutionalize, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I know I've told you the story about tapping in Rwanda. So these people, tapping researchers, go into Rwanda, and they're supposed to do some tapping, and they go to a school with traumatized kids. 100% of the kids have PTSD. And they do a couple rounds of tapping and whatever they're doing. And at the end of the time, you go from 100% with PTSD to 6 or 8% with PTSD. Now, how does that happen in 2 weeks? Mm-hmm. You know, this is one of the worst things that can happen to a person is they get this escalated nervous system that goes on and on and on, right? Well, something happened at the school, and I think these kids were treated savagely and saw horrific things. The researchers had to leave. But part of the design of the study was to come back in a year and see what results held, right? So they come back in a year, even though they've only done a couple of sessions. At the end of the year, at the end of the first 2 weeks, 94% no longer meet the criteria for PTSD. They come back in a year, and 92% don't meet the criteria. Now, that's ridiculous. That's not cool, man. That's not possible. Anyway, of course, it's the schoolmaster, the principal, or whatever they call him. He sees the effect of the tapping on the kids, and he institutionalizes it, right? He says, oh, my God, this really works. So then every time a kid has an episode, everybody's tapping on everybody, tapping on themselves. And at the end of the year, they're still in really good shape. So, you know, the lesson for me is we have to institutionalize these practices, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't start with the kids or the people we're trying to treat. They start with us, right? Yeah. You know, Barack Obama, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, he said, they asked him, what's the next step in your career? And he says, I'm going to go out there and change the world. I'm going to train people to go out there and change the world. That's the first and only time I've ever disagreed with him, because you got to go in here. You got to go inside to change the world. It starts in here. And it starts in here for every person. And so the suffering these people have can only be alleviated by settling their bodies and doing that with other people. They co-regulate, you know? Like the big term these days is self-regulate, teach kids to self-regulate. Who self-regulates? Mm-hmm. Not me.
Right.
You know, you have a problem, you go looking for a friend, mm-hmm. right? Because you trust them and they make you feel better, right? Turns off your limbic alarm system, you know? So anyway, it's for me, it all begins with the body. And I have seen dramatic changes in people when they settle their body down in their capacity to reason, be compassionate to others, perspective take, do all of these higher order executive things we want them to do. But you got to start with the body. So
how are you listed in some of the examples there of some of those techniques? The swimming is really good for this, the breathing, the washcloth over the face, tapping. You've got a website that describes 10 these and then other examples. And we'll put this on our website so folks can find yours. But if I, as a parent or I'm a teacher and I recognize, you know, I want to institutionalize, as it were, this in my classroom or in my home, which of those 10 would you say try? Or maybe one or two of those, would you say that these are kind of easy? Even if the kid's not buying into it yet, do this around them. What would you point us to?
You know, does anybody want to do these techniques? No. And kids who act up, do you want to be singled out? Okay, now go breathe. No, of course not. You know, so, you know, God was wise enough to install mirror neurons in our brains. And so mirror neurons mean that when I do something, I have a certain pattern of firing. When I watch somebody else do something, I have the same. So, I'm sorry. When I do something, I have a certain pattern of firing in my brain, right? When another person watches me do that, they have the same pattern of firing in their brain, right? So, I never push anybody to do this. I just do it, right? Just do it. And I have never, ever had a single person who didn't join in, right? So, it always begin with that, and then, you know, make it model, you know, be the person you want them to become. So do it with them. I say, you know, I just had this meeting again the other day with somebody who said, well, we got to teach this kid to regulate himself. No, you have to regulate with him. Why would you ever miss the opportunity to to build trust between you and him by doing it together, right? Regulate together always. And, you know, some people will learn how to do that on their own, which is fine. But the power is in people, right? The power is in relationships. So, and, you know, we really don't have a relationship-based treatment model. Yeah, mm-hmm. We're still muckling on to kids, right? And old people. You know, if I say people have been restrained in our country, in this country, the United States, in every town and city and every state, and probably every day, right? What's the rationale behind that? You know, if my wife didn't do something I didn't like her to do or talk back to me or told me whatever. You know, if I restrained her for doing that, I'd be in jail. So where's the rationale that we can do this to children? Right? Yeah. And, you know, the other part of the problem is this. I often see kids around the age of 15 who have developmental disabilities or autism who are kicking ass. Mm-hmm. Well, when you ask them, anybody ever knock you on the ground, drag you down the hall, stuff you in a room? Of course. Of course. Look at their records. So what is the message? The message we're teaching these kids is the biggest person wins. And so when they become the biggest person, they're just doing what we taught them to do. And so, you know, those things are just increase people's suffering and make life worse mm-hmm. for everybody. Because nobody enjoys doing it. But it's just that people convince you that this is the way to help people. But, you know, it's so crazy.
Now I'm thinking, and you may, I think, have answered this question in some ways. On your website, you've got some great quotes, one of which is from Emily Dickinson's poem, "Hope is the Thing with Feathers." And I'm curious, in the midst of the suffering that we see, particularly right now with an epidemic, a mental health crisis, increase in suicide, so many things we're all concerned about, where is it? Or rather, what gives you hope in the midst of all this?
What gives me hope, Matthew, is that you can reduce people's suffering and you can reduce children's suffering. And you can do it pretty quickly if you know what you're doing, you know, and you can do the opposite if you don't know what you're doing, you know. So some really basic stuff just drives me. You know, I meet a new kid who's suffering, and I think, so you know, I start from the point where I understand it's suffering. I don't think it's bad behavior. You know, I just saw this little guy with autism, and he's clearly overwhelmed with his situation, and he sort of runs down the middle of this trailer and turns around and runs away from his mother and then turns around and runs back and bites her. So what did I just see? I saw an attempted escape, attempted manage his arousal not to be so high, couldn't get away because there was no place to go. And it's freeze, flight, fight. Flight didn't work. He turned to fight and bit his mother, right? I ended up doing a bunch of different things with him. But anyway, by the end of the evening, he was sitting calmly. And, you know, the mother, so he said, "Well, what are the things that the kid makes the kid feel calm?" And she said, "Well, one of the things that makes him feel calm is getting in the bath." She said, "But I was told that kid's seven. He's nonverbal. He says a few words, but not much, you know. And the autism specialist, you know, I think watch out for people with the specialist after their name. They told her that she shouldn't give him a bath because he likes it. And this is all attention-seeking behavior. You know, you can't know anything about child development and think any of that is true. And if you look at this little guy, he's sweet as can be, you know. And I've done a number of times I've been over the place and helped out with him a little bit. And the last time I was there, we put on some low-frequency sounds in the background. Audio-visual entrainment is what it's called. But your brain entrains to the sounds it hears, and pretty quickly, within a couple of minutes. So we put some low alpha, high theta. So it's delta is the lowest frequency, then theta. Delta is sleep. Theta is kind of like, you know, between half asleep and half awake when you're just waking up in the morning. Incredibly creative point. Alpha is calm, and low beta is thinking and processing and all of that. High beta is anxiety, and then gamma's on the top there and does a whole bunch of stuff as well. But we put on high theta, low alpha tunes, and oh my gosh, the whole trailer settled down in just a couple of minutes. His language improved, and he doesn't like to be touched really. Some of the techniques require touching. While he was sitting, and he sat for 45 minutes, I used some acupressure points on his neck and rubbed his head, and he tolerated that for 45 minutes. And he held my hand. He's regulated. You know, in the authentic self that we find in every person is this person who needs to be in relationship with others. And when they get dysregulated, they don't trust, they're in fear, they can't engage, you know? So we got to get those bodies settled down, the brain settled down. And, you know, I also tried to do, this was sort of fun, I brought a bunch of cups over. Now, did you ever meet a kid who don't like to blow bubbles?
Mm-hmm. Okay. No.
Put chocolate milk in air, put a straw in, put a cap on it so it doesn't get everywhere. And they're, before they're drinking, they're blowing bubbles, right? So that's a technique we use with a lot of little guys, gals. And anyway, I was with his brother, who's probably four. His sister's probably nine. And we each, one of us had cups who were blowing in. And he got really excited and kept coming over and drinking the water out of the cups. We couldn't get him to blow. But again, you know, something as simple as a long exhale and a short inhale, you know, six breaths a minute, and your arousal's down. Your heart rate is down. Your blood pressure's down. Your heart rate variability's up. So all those markers work really well. And, it, you know, so you just got to figure out whether it's pinwheels or sometimes we blow on soup or, you know, do things like that, that the kid already has in their procedural memory. They know how to do.
So, Al, you have all these almost 50 years of expertise working with a whole range of little kids to adults, a whole range, and making such an impact on them. What about the rest of us, those listening to this podcast, who want to make a difference, who want to give some hope in the midst of this really challenging time? What recommendation would you give to them? How can they be a source of hope? How can we, I should say, be a source of hope?
Well, you know, we've talked about compassion fatigue already, which is really empathy fatigue, right? Compassion is about feeling for somebody but being able to help them, right? And compassion feels really good. Empathy fatigue is, I feel bad for you, but I can't help you. You can help everybody. Everybody can be helped if we do it the right way. And this is not rocket science. This is simple. Let's start with the body, lower their arousal, do it with them, and do the simple but profound things like smile, right? You know, what did Mother Teresa say? Smiling is the first step toward peace. She also said we'll never understand how a simple smile is so effective. And the fact is, we actually do know that already, right? So we know that when people smile at you, it turns on your left brain approach system and positive thoughts and positive feelings. It also shuts off your right brain, shuts down your negative thoughts, negative feelings, and desire to withdraw. So, you know, when we start seeing kids, you know, they're real good people. They know, they don't know the science maybe, but they know, you know, engage with somebody, smile, laugh, play, right? Mm-hmm. Play turns off your defensive systems. Caretaking turns off your defensive systems. You want to turn somebody around real quick, ask them for help. Right? Just say, hey, you know, like when we do our sessions in the mindful support group, not only are the people in charge of the group, so that does a whole bunch of stuff in terms of learned helplessness and control and agency and all of that, but we also put them in a leadership role out of the group. Right? So we have a kid we're working with. The first day we breathed with him, and he's a real tough kid. The first day we breathed with him, he decided to go back and teach his teachers at school. And so
that's
now,
so now
we're going to do this 10-minute challenge with him, where we're going to breathe for this specific kind of bumblebee breathing for about a minute every hour during school. And we're calling it the 10-minute challenge, right? Can you change your behavior in 10 minutes a day? And the answer is yes. There's no question the answer is yes. So, you know, the other thing I think it's important to remember is, you know, in the behavior business is like the restaurant business. You know, the restaurant business, you're only good as your last meal. And in the behavior business, the kid is only as good as his last behavior. So as soon as something goes wrong, they're back at the level one, you know? Everybody's down on them. That doesn't build hope. It destroys hope, right?
Yeah.
I have never been in a situation with somebody who did something, even quite violent, that I couldn't find something good to say. You got the building blocks. So we had a kid a few weeks ago. He was blowing up regularly. They called the police on him, a whole bunch of stuff. We started our groups with him. And after, it was 9 or 10 weeks before he had another episode, right? Now, it's violence. It's just tough to handle. And they call the police and he goes to the emergency room and all kinds of stuff like that. The whole group gathered. And I think I started and said, you know, you proved it. You can do it, right? Had a setback, okay. But what really happened is you went 9 or 10 weeks without it.
Yeah.
You've proven you can do it. And then the case manager said, you know, I met him at the hospital. And he was so compliant and he talked to the doctor. And all of a sudden, you know, think of his ego boost from everybody just being positive about him. You know, so there's never a point where you can't find something somebody tried to do that was good. And so you got to go for the good, not for the bad. Right, the bad you got, they're already doing it, right? Let's see if we can find something. And, you know, our mindful support group, that's part of the process, is we say, what are the good things you did this week? What can we celebrate? What can we compliment you on? What can we show gratitude for that you've done this week, you know? And so I had a kid, a person recently, who the team said, well, you know, he does great in these groups, but he doesn't do good in school. And, you know, what does that mean? I said, well, that means he doesn't feel safe in school and he feels accepted and safe in the group. So don't criticize the group. I got to say that these groups are about some of the most wonderful people you'll ever meet. I mean, these home provider staff and case managers and all of these people are just, they're terrific. You know, they're so terrific. You know, I had a gal the other day tell the person who lives with her, you know, she said, protect your peace, right? Not like cut it out, but do the things you need to do to protect your peace. And I thought, wow, what a great way to think about it, you know? And she's not a sophisticated gal, you know? She's smart as a whip and kind and good, but, you know, she doesn't have any degrees or anything like that. But I never heard anybody with a degree say something that profound.
So
we can help each and every one of these people, Matthew. We just have to figure out the ways to do that, you know, and celebrate every step in their success.
From today's interview, what would you like folks to write down to remember if they were to put that on a note card?
I guess it's really back to regulate, relate, reason. And realize that there are different strategies for each one of those things. If you ever want to get to reason, learning, etc., you got to do the first two. The first one is body-based. You want to go to the brainstem. You got to do heavy-duty regulation activities together. And go take a walk and those other things. The next is, if you want people to feel safe with you, first of all, regulating together is one of the best ways. Then bombard them with signals of safety, right? Help them feel safe. Share positive affects. Caretake them. You know, woman Beverly James, she said, that if you ever want to get to counseling people, you first have to take care of them, right? You want people to listen to you, take care of them. That's the prerequisite, right? So think about your relationship, and then you can help people think about things. You know, my work has been mostly in developmental disability, as always, lots of other kinds of people, lots of mental health stuff. But, you know, we're inclined to put labels on people, say you're depressed, you're anxious. You know, I'm okay with that, I guess. But I think a lot of this comes from experience, right? And you call it traumatic experience, probably a lot of it is, but it's experience. It's what you learn and what your body learns to do in these situations. If you want people to feel safe with you, you have to do the things that make them feel safe, right? You can't say, well, so you did that. Why did you do it? What happened right before? What happened right after? That doesn't make people feel safe, right? I mean, I don't know what you, I know you get a salary, Matthew. Who cares what it is? But if I was your boss and I said, Matthew, I think you're a little bit late on Wednesday and I'm going to have to dock your paycheck this week. I don't, that's not going to help, is it? No. If I say, Matthew, you know, I saw you were late. I saw the look on your face. I'm worried about you. You know, what can I do for you? You're going to be, it's going to be real positive, right? And then, you know, at some point I can say, Matthew, you know, if you're late all the time, because you're regulated, we're regulated together, and we relate well. Hey, what are we going to do about your time? About coming in late, and you will overreact. You'll say, "You're right. We got to talk about it, and it's okay." But not till you do the first two.
Yeah.
And you know, literally, you know, when you're young, if you're fortunate enough to have reasonable parents who are right 75% of the time, you get all that. But at some point, we stop doing it for each other. Right. And so people with really challenging behavior, we got to go back to basics. We got to go back to that early stuff and just repeat it. And you know, the other thing is what Leo said, my son, you know, be kind all the time. And when people are struggling, be even kinder.
You can learn more about Al and his work at his website, tamingthetigervt.com. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline can be reached in the United States by calling or texting 988. It's free and available 24/7. Hope and Healing was produced by Jenny Hoheisel and John Moe. Music by concert rock violinist Aaron Meyer. This podcast is presented by Children's Center in Vancouver, Washington. Children's Center's mission is to serve children, youth, and families through comprehensive, community-based mental health services. For more information, visit thechildrencenter.org. I'm Matthew Butte, and thank you for listening.